All my life, I'd been the smartest guy in any room. Even when I was a little kid, I always excelled at everything. All my teachers loved me, except when I corrected them in class. I couldn't help it. When I started university, I assumed that I'd be the top student there. Unfortunately, I was number two. There was this guy named James whose grades were just a fraction of a point higher than mine. He wasn't smarter than me. He was just friendlier to the professors. That was it. Because of his social skills, he'd end up the valedictorian, while I'd be stuck with second place. I couldn't have that. I had to figure out a way to stop him. I checked out all his social media accounts and found out that he was interested in meditation and spiritual wellness. I thought all that stuff was idiotic, but I used that information to create a fake Instagram account of a spiritual guru from Bhutan. My parents had taken me there a few summers ago, so I had a bunch of photos that I could use. He fell for it right away. I guess he really wasn't as smart as he thought. We exchanged texts for days. It was really easy to build his trust and get him to confess to some really personal stuff. Despite his outwardly friendly personality, he was actually depressed. The pressure to be the best was really getting to him, and he was terrified of our upcoming finals. I made up a bunch of bullshit advice about daily affirmations, meditation, even meal prep. It was innocent and harmless at first, which was how I was able to build his trust. After a week, I could tell that James was becoming dependent on my advice. With exams just around the corner, I decided to throw him off his game by sending him increasingly dark comments to bring out his depression. I sent him quotes about death and heaven. Death is the ultimate liberating reality. In a matter of days, I had taken him to a very dark place. His messages sounded more desperate, like all he could think about was the afterlife, a place free from all this stress and anxiety. So I made the single biggest mistake of my life. I convinced him to go out to the forest behind campus and dig a big pit where he could stay there and be closer to God. I told him not to bring any food or water, just himself. It was a seriously messed up suggestion, but he did what I said. He trusted me. He didn't show up for classes the next day, or the day after that. No one knew where he was, and he didn't respond to any of my texts. I was racked with guilt. I couldn't concentrate on anything. On the morning before our final exams, I gave up on studying and headed for the forest behind campus. I spent hours looking, but didn't find any trace of him. Then, when I was about to give up, I saw a pile of fresh dirt in a clearing. I ran closer and found a deep pit that someone had dug into the ground. And at the bottom of the pit was James's lifeless body. He was lying face down. "James, are you okay?" I pulled out my phone and tried to call 911. No signal. Who knows how long he'd been lying there, slowly dying because of me, because I'd manipulated him. I had to get him out of there, now. I lowered myself over the edge of the pit and slid down the soft dirt. When I reached his motionless body, I grabbed his shoulders and carefully turned him over. That's when his head fell off. This wasn't James at all. It was a mannequin dressed in James's clothes. Someone was at the top of the pit laughing down at me. I looked up and saw James, the real James, standing over me with a devious smile on his face.
"Did you really think you'd trick me into hanging out in a frickin' hole?"
He calmly, mockingly explained that he'd known I was trying to trick him from the very beginning. He was surprised to see how far I'd taken things. The last few days, he'd skipped classes to spend all his time studying for his exams and waiting for me to crumble under my guilt. The last thing he said before he disappeared from view was, "Good luck with finals, man." Now that I was alone, just me and that stupid mannequin, I felt like a complete idiot. James had proven his point. And since I spent almost no time preparing for our exams, there was no doubt that I had lost my chance at valedictorian. But in a way, I guess it was worth it. I allowed my competitive nature to get the best of me. I'd never do that again. I started climbing out of the pit, but the soft dirt just crumbled in my hands. I tried again. Failed again. I couldn't get traction. It took me 10 minutes and dozens of attempts to finally admit to myself that I was trapped in here. I couldn't climb out. Just as James had intended. Help! Please! No matter how much I screamed, no one could hear me. I was too far from the trail. I spent 3 torturous days in that pit, dehydrated and starving. I held on to hope for that first day, convincing myself that someone would find me. By the second day, I knew I was going to die. And finally, just before sunset on the third day, when I was too weak to move, I heard footsteps above me. Voices, too. I thought I was imagining things at first, until I heard James's voice.
Oh my God! There he is!
He'd returned with a couple paramedics. I couldn't see how many. I don't remember what happened after that. I guess I passed out. When I woke up, I was in a hospital bed. Still sore, but definitely feeling better. James was sitting by my side.
Good morning. You look so much better.
Sorry you had to miss all your final exams.
Furious, I started screaming at him. I told him that I'd tell everyone what he'd done. That he'd get arrested for luring me out there and leaving me to die.
He smiled and waited for my outburst to end, and then he patted me on the shoulder. I think you're misremembering things, my friend. You tricked me. If you tell the truth, then you're exposing yourself, too. It's best if you just forget this whole thing ever happened. Our college had its graduation ceremony that month. As expected, James was valedictorian. I was still recovering in the hospital. I'll have to retake my last semester this summer, if I'm well enough. Huh. I guess James proved that he really was the smartest guy in school. This story is loosely based on a real-world incident. In 2024, remains found in Salt Lake City were identified as Douglas Brick, a University of Utah student who vanished over 50 years ago. Brick, a 23-year-old senior from Idaho, disappeared on October 12, 1973, last seen leaving his dorm. The cold case remained unsolved until hunters discovered skull fragments in foothills near the university. On April 30th, DNA analysis confirmed the remains belonged to Brick. His family, notified on May 3rd, expressed relief at finally having answers after decades of uncertainty. For the university, solving its only known cold case after 51 years was described as nothing short of a miracle. I was halfway through my evening shift at the gas station when the man stumbled through the door. At first glance, he looked drunk, ragged breathing, eyes not focusing right, blood matting one side of his salt and pepper hair. He swayed near the candy aisle, bumping into the shelf like a zombie. I stepped from behind the bulletproof glass, against every damn rule they drilled into us during training. "Sir?" I called, phone in hand. "You okay?" He didn't answer, just blinked like I wasn't real. As I got closer, I saw the gash on his forehead. Ugly. He smelled like sweat and dried leaves. He mumbled something I couldn't make out. "Did you fall? Were you in a crash?" I asked, dialing 911. "Sit down, all right? Help's coming."
Where the f***? "Fuck am I?"
he finally managed, voice gravelly and low.
"Just stay still, don't move too much,"
I said, trying not to panic. My hands were shaking, but I didn't want him to see. The dispatcher on the line asked if he was conscious, breathing, bleeding. I gave short answers. I wasn't trained for this. I sold gas, chips, and scratch-offs, not emergency care. Paramedics arrived within 10 minutes. Police, too. They took one look at him and exchanged glances I didn't understand. "Possible skull fracture," one EMT muttered as they loaded him onto the gurney. "Maybe a concussion. Did he fall?" I didn't see a car wreck," I said. "He just walked in like that." "All right," the officer said, nodding. "We'll check it out." They left with the guy, sirens wailing back into the night. I went back to my little glass cage. The rest of the shift was quiet. Dead quiet. My ears rang in the silence, like they were trying to warn me something still wasn't right. At around 2:30 a.m., the same cops rolled back in. Officer Grant, mid-40s, heavyset, always ordered two creamers and no sugar.
"Hey,"
he said, pouring himself some burnt gas station coffee.
"You got a minute?"
"Sure," I said, trying to look casual. "What happened to that guy?" They exchanged a look again. This one different, like they didn't quite know how to say it. Grant cleared his throat.
"Well, turns out your mystery man was trying to break into a house a few blocks down. Belongs to some social media chick. Insta-famous or whatever. Huge following."
"Wait, what?"
"He wasn't drunk. That head wound," he said, stirring his coffee. "She hit him with a Louisville slugger. Right in the temple. Guy was crawling out her backyard when he disappeared. You were just his pit stop."
My stomach turned cold.
"She said he climbed in through the second-story balcony. Had a duffel bag with rope, duct tape, gloves, the works."
"What the hell?" Grant looked me dead in the eye.
"He told her he hated her. Wanted to teach her a lesson by f***ing her." His words. "Sick bastard."
I leaned against the counter. My knees weren't cooperating anymore.
"He's wanted for rape in Texas," Grant continued. "And two murders in Nevada and Arizona. Been on the run for a year."
I stared at the counter. The man's dried blood was still caked in the tile cracks.
"I helped him," I whispered.
"You didn't know," Grant said. "Hell, neither did we. She almost killed him. Self-defense, no doubt, but still."
He sipped his coffee, as if all of this was just another Thursday night. When they left, I locked the front door for the rest of my shift. Didn't care if it broke protocol. If the manager wanted to fire me, so be it. A few days later, a reporter came by asking questions. I didn't say much, just that he came in bleeding, and I did what any decent person would have done. A few nights after that, a customer came in. Young, twitchy, stank of vape juice and cologne.
"You the guy from the news?"
he asked, recognizing me. "Guess so." He looked around.
"That guy said something when he left her house, right before she hit him."
"What?"
"She looked just like the last one," he said, tapping his temple. "Crazy, huh?"
That stuck with me. The last one. I pulled up articles about the women he'd attacked. They all had a type. Slim, brunette, big social following. Online personas more than people. All variations of the same fantasy. And the girl he tried to attack? Her name was Emma Lee. Real name? Emily Hansen. She had 2 million followers. Sponsored workout videos. A line of protein powders. Pretty. Bubbly. Always smiling. But one thing didn't make sense. Emma posted a video 3 days later thanking everyone for their support. She said she heard a noise on the balcony. But the police report said he came in through the front after jimmying the lock. Someone was lying. I dug a little deeper. Found a thread on Reddit that speculated on the whole event. Someone claimed that the guy had dated Emma back in college. Another claimed she lured him there, knowing he'd try something, and had the camera rolling the whole time for proof. One comment even said, she knew he was coming. She waited for him. I tried to let it go. I really did. Until 2 weeks later, I got a package at the station. No name. Just a USB drive. I checked the CCTV footage, but nothing. Whoever dropped it off knew our blind spots. Back home, I plugged it in. A single video file. It was Emma. In her living room. Camera on a tripod. She was facing the door.
"You came back,"
she said, smiling slightly. "Took you long enough." The front door opened.
The man from the gas station walked in slowly, head down. No blood. He wasn't injured.
"You said I could help you," he muttered.
She walked over and whispered something that I couldn't make out. Then, black screen. No struggle, no bat, no scream, just a cut to black. I never showed it to the cops. I was confused and scared. I still am. This story is inspired from a real-life experience shared by one of our subscribers. This is what they said. I was working the night shift at a gas station when a dazed man walked in, bleeding from a head wound. He looked lost and confused, so I stepped out from behind the glass booth, against policy, and called emergency services. Paramedics suspected a head fracture and took him to the hospital. A few hours later, cops came back for coffee and told me the truth. The guy had been hit with a bat while trying to sneak into a woman's bedroom. He was already wanted for assault and murder in two other states. During my night shifts, I never stepped out of the booth again after that.
I thought Emily and I had a happy marriage. We had our arguments, like any couple, but they never seemed too bad. Then, she blindsided me one night after I got home late from work. She told me she was tired of raising her son without me. She said I was never home, and she was thinking about divorce. I would do anything to make Emily happy, but I also loved my job. I was a policeman, and I'd sworn an oath to serve and protect. Law enforcement was in my blood, and I couldn't give that up. That said, I was a bit of a workaholic. From now on, I promised myself that I'd put my family first. No more extra shifts, no more evenings filling in for my coworkers, and when I was at home, no more talking about ongoing cases. Our son Anthony's birthday party was that weekend, and Emily made me promise to be there on time no matter what. I was supposed to dress up in a dinosaur costume and surprise him. If I missed it, she was going to leave me. This was my last chance. I took her warning very seriously. I bought a race car toy that I knew Anthony would love. On the big day, I finished all my work early. I was driving home when I heard one last call on the radio. It was from Nadine, one of our dispatches. She was a personal friend, and like me, she took her job very seriously. She said a car was speeding recklessly through a residential neighborhood. Witnesses claimed there were explosives in the back seat. All other units were dispatched, so I was the only one who could stop it. I knew I was risking my marriage and my son's happiness, but I had a duty to protect the public. I changed directions and turned on my siren. I told Nadine that I was on my way. I was on the hunt for a blue station wagon in the Lakeview area. I searched all the main streets, but I couldn't find it. I radioed Nadine to ask for any updates. She told me that the car had gotten all the way to Parkside on the other end of town. Now I knew I definitely was going to be late. I drove even faster. I made it to the new location, but I still couldn't see the suspicious vehicle. In fact, traffic was moving along as if nothing had happened. I radioed in again to get more information. By then, my cell phone was buzzing. I didn't need to look at it. I knew it was Emily. I was driving too fast to answer her. That's when Nadine radioed in one more time, saying it was a false alarm, that I could head home. I can't tell you how furious I was. A false alarm had just cost me everything. I sped back home, but by the time I got there, Anthony had already opened all his presents and eaten his cake. He was running around in the backyard with his friends. I tried to tell Emily what happened, but she didn't care. She said I'd chosen my job over my family. She wanted me out of the house. She let me stay long enough to give Anthony his present. Then I was out the door. I didn't even get to wear the dinosaur costume. Feeling absolutely miserable, I went to the bar near the station. It was mostly empty, but I spotted Nadine drinking by herself. I knew it wasn't her fault that she'd sent me on a wild goose chase, but I needed someone to blame. I sat next to her and told her that the false alarm had ruined my life. I expected an apology. Not for her to put her hand on my thigh.
"So you're single now, huh?"
There was something about the look in her eyes. She was horny, But more importantly, she didn't seem surprised at all. I knew in my bones she'd done this to me on purpose. She wanted to ruin my marriage. I pulled away. Tomorrow, I'd like to hear that 911 call. Can you send me the recording? She got really flustered and said that it would be best for me if I didn't dwell on the past. That proved to me there was no 911 call. Okay, if you say so. I could very easily get her fired for what she'd done, but I had a better idea. Something more fun. So I flirted with her just enough to prove that I was interested. And then I told her to meet me at the Motel 6. She immediately agreed. Head up to room 12 in 1 hour. I'll be waiting for you there. I told her I was interested in a little role play. That surprised her, but she said she was down for anything. I went straight to the motel and dropped the dinosaur costume on the bed. I left a note. Put this on and wait for me. I'll be there soon. I waited outside the motel until I saw her check in. Then I waited a few more minutes to make sure she had enough time to put on the costume. Then I called 911.
Hello? I'd like to report a prostitute in room 12 of the Motel 6. She's into some really kinky stuff, and it's disturbing the other guests. Please come right away.
And that's how I got my revenge. The body cam footage showed Nadine dressed as a T-Rex, completely unable to explain herself. The entire department couldn't stop laughing when they saw it. That was 3 months ago, and literally everyone I've ever met has seen the footage. I made sure to spread it around. Nadine quit the force before she got fired. Because I called in a false 911 call, my sergeant had to put me on 2 weeks of unpaid leave, no matter how funny he thought my prank was. I used that time to patch things up with Emily. We're better now than ever. As of this month, I'm officially back on patrol, but I've learned my lesson. Family always comes first. This story is loosely based on a real-world event. In October 2015, a bizarre 911 call baffled Iowa City police. At 2:45 a.m., University of Iowa student Kelsey Cousins, 20, intoxicated and rambling, identified herself as Olivia Pope, the fictional fixer from TV's Scandal. She claimed to see Cyrus Bean outside a bar and warned of a bomb. Officers found Cousins visibly drunk, with slurred speech, poor balance, and a blood alcohol level of 0.206. Charged with public intoxication and misuse of the 911 system, her call proved to be nothing more than an alcohol-fueled fantasy. I'm 78 years old. I've lived a long, mostly happy life. But I've also had my share of heartache. My husband died. I lost one son in Afghanistan. And I had to have a hip replaced. But when you get to my age, you've seen it all. At least, that's what I thought. I wasn't prepared for last month, when I had my Uber ride from hell. I can't drive anymore because of my eyesight, so I used an Uber to get home from a bingo game with the girls. It was a wonderful night. I won $15. The car pulled up and I got in. My driver was a young gal, probably in her 20s. She had long, beautiful red hair. I've always loved redheads. She seemed friendly at first. As we drove, I told her some of my bingo stories. But halfway through the ride, she started driving crazy. She was speeding, and she kept drifting onto the shoulder. I didn't say anything at first, but her driving kept getting worse. I was scared.
Excuse me, miss. Can you please slow down?
She ignored me. And she did not slow down.
Please, miss, you're going too fast!
That made her speed up. She started driving in the wrong lane. It was like she wanted to scare me, and it worked. I never felt more terrified. As she swerved around a corner, narrowly missing a truck, I finally had enough.
Stop! Let me out!
The woman slammed on her brakes. We were in the middle of nowhere, miles away from my destination. But I needed to get out of there. I unbuckled my seatbelt and stumbled outside. I felt dizzy. Without saying anything, the woman got out of the car too. She casually walked toward me.
Ma'am, are you sure you're safe all the way out here?
Safer than in the back seat.
I turned my back to her and got out my phone. I decided to call Dorothy to come pick me up. I didn't trust this cab service anymore. As I was dialing, I heard the woman mutter behind me. Then I felt a jolt of pain in the back of my head. The psycho punched me. I stumbled forward and landed hard on the ground. I didn't break anything, but my head was throbbing. I twisted around to look at my attacker. She was standing over me, arms crossed with a blank expression.
Why are you doing this?
Why not? I've always wanted to hurt someone, like I've been hurt. And tonight I finally decided to go for it. You're just my unlucky victim. She nudged me with her foot, just because she could. As she walked back and forth, she bragged about how she could do anything she wanted to me. She said I was just a helpless old lady. That last part was what finally pushed me over the edge. Yes, I was an old lady, but I refused to be helpless. I've lived through too much to let myself be tormented by a complete stranger. I ignored the pain in my head and the cuts on my bloody hands. Then I grabbed a sharp rock just a few inches away. The woman crouched down and grabbed my hair. She was gonna pull me to my feet. That's when I struck. I stood up, pain shooting through my new hip, and struck her again. She fell against the side of her car, obviously surprised that I was fighting back. Well, she picked the wrong old lady. She swung at me, but I stepped to the side. In my 78 years of living, I'd never been in a fight before. My husband Clarence always took care of me. But somehow, I felt like I knew exactly what to do. I hit her once more with the rock, right in the face, and she crumpled to the ground. Her face was bloody, and I think some of her teeth were missing. But she didn't look scared. In fact, she was smiling. I waited for her to make another move. I was ready for her, but she didn't. She just kept smiling. And that's when I heard the police sirens.
Drop the rock!
A cop car had pulled up behind me. Two policemen were aiming their guns at me. With my bad hearing, I hadn't heard their arrival. And as they got closer, the woman's triumphant smile turned into a look of complete terror.
Please help me, officers! This bitch attacked me out of nowhere!
As the policeman put me in handcuffs, my psycho driver made up a long story about how I'd attacked her from the back seat. Apparently, I forced her to pull over, got out of the car, and pretended to have a heart attack. Then, when she went to check on me, I attacked her with a rock. The story was absolutely insane, but the police believed her. I tried to tell them what really happened, but they were already pushing me toward the car. I felt hopeless. Without any witnesses, it was her word against mine, and she was a lot more wounded than me. Then I noticed something on the ground.
Wait, my phone!
One of the officers picked it up, looked at it, then put it to his ear.
Hello? Yes. No, she's fine. The other lady, though, okay.
He looked at his fellow officer and told him to uncuff me. I guess there was a witness after all. My phone call to Dorothy went through, and she heard everything. My driver realized she was caught. She ran as fast as she could. One of the cops caught up to her and tackled her to the ground. Now the right person was in handcuffs. The other cop told Dorothy to come to the station to make a statement, and then he handed the phone to me.
Dorothy, thank you so much. You saved my life. Oh no, dear. It sounded to me like you saved yourself.
The story is inspired from a real-life event. A 78-year-old Auburn Hills woman told that on March 14th, she was taking an Uber to her desired location. And shortly into the ride, the driver, a 27-year-old Detroit woman, began driving recklessly. The passenger asked the driver to let her out of the vehicle. The passenger said that after she exited the vehicle, the driver punched her in the back of her head. An investigation is ongoing.
Every summer, my sister Greta and I visited our grandparents in Minnesota. Even though they were both pretty old and sickly, they were great people. Grandma Pat would fix us some amazing meals. Grandpa Nick would show off his garden, and both of them would always surprise us with little practical jokes, like water buckets balanced on the door, or fake body parts buried in our guest beds. Despite their health, they were both young at heart. That's why I was so happy when they decided to move to a retirement community in Florida. The weather would be better for them, and they'd have a lot more opportunities to be social and active. We didn't visit them last year because they were still moving in. But this summer, Greta and I decided to fly down there and stay for a whole week. When our grandparents picked us up at the airport, they looked like completely different people. They seemed so much healthier now. Happy too. It was amazing how much they changed since we last saw them. As we drove to their place, Grandpa Nick asked us a lot of strange questions. He asked what we typically ate. He asked how much exercise we got in a week. He even asked if we were smokers. Greta was more than happy to tell them that I was a smoker and she wasn't. Grandma and Grandpa exchanged glances. It seemed like they really cared about living healthy now. When I got to their gated community, I couldn't believe how beautifully it was. All the houses were huge and every street had a view of the ocean. A bunch of their neighbors drove by us in golf carts. They were all just as old as our grandparents, but they also seemed very healthy and active. Everyone smiled and waved, and a few of them even invited us to their house for dinner while we were visiting. I had a really good feeling about this community. If everything was good as I thought it was, our parents would live long, happy lives. That night, I was deep asleep when Greta ran into my room and shook me awake. She looked scared. I asked her what was wrong, and she said that Grandma Pat had snuck into her room and stood at the foot of her bed, staring at her as she slept. It sounded creepy, but I told her not to worry about it. Older people act strange sometimes, especially after sundown. Greta asked if she could sleep in my room, but I told her no. I didn't want her snoring to wake me up. The next morning, I woke up with an uneasy feeling. It was like I sensed something was wrong. I went to the kitchen where both my grandparents were eating breakfast. Greta wasn't there. I asked them where she was, and Grandma Pat told me not to worry about it. She said that Greta had to leave early, but I was free to stay as long as I wanted. I knew that my grandma was lying to me. Greta would never leave in the middle of the night without telling me. Something had happened to her. I tried to reason with them, but Grandpa Nick told me to stop asking questions. He tried to get me to sit down and eat breakfast with them, but I just left them there and ran to Greta's room. Her bed was made, which is something that Greta seldom did, and her luggage was gone. I also noticed that the bedroom window was wide open. Greta would never leave the window open like that. I made sure my grandparents couldn't hear me, and then I snuck through the window and into the backyard. I could see fresh marks on the ground. It looks like Greta had been dragged away. I followed the marks to the community center at the end of the street. I passed an old lady who was watering her yard. She asked me how I was doing. I told her I was just fine. I didn't want to give her any other information. The woman kept staring at me, but I continued all the way to the community center. The door was unlocked, so I walked in and saw what looked like a giant hospital room. There were trays filled with medical equipment and several operating tables. Then, I saw Greta tied to a table in the center of the room. Her mouth was gagged and she was barely moving. I pulled the gag out of her mouth and asked her what was going on. "Help," she whispered. "I think they took my kidney." She was so drugged up that she could barely speak. I saw that her shirt was stained with blood. I pulled up the shirt to see a nasty scar across the side of her stomach. It was stitched together and very fresh. She was still bleeding. "Help," she whispered again, and then she passed out. That's when I finally pieced together the awful truth. This wasn't just a normal retirement community. Everyone here was healthy because they were stealing organs. And worst of all, my grandparents must have been in on it too. I tried to untie Greta, but the straps were pretty tight around her wrists. We needed to get out of there. Just as I had gotten one of her hands loose, I heard slow clapping from the door behind me. I turned around to see my grandma standing there. She was grinning darkly. "You found her," she said. "You're smarter than I thought." "You're stealing organs?" I asked. She walked farther into the room, still smiling widely. Grandpa Nick walked in behind her, but he didn't say anything. It's just a practical joke, Grandma Pat said. Your sister was in on it the whole time. I looked down at Greta to see if her drugged-out state was just an act. I looked at the slice along her stomach, too, and that sure looked real. Greta opened her mouth to say something, but nothing came out. Then, Grandpa walked over to the operating table and slid his finger along Greta's open wound. He licked the blood off his fingertip. It's just syrup, he said. It's all a big joke. 5 or 6 other neighbors walked into the room, too. They were all smiling and laughing. You're all in on it? I asked them. That made everyone laugh even harder. As Grandma assured me that this was just some elaborate joke, Grandpa took Greta's operating table and started wheeling it into another room. Let's get you cleaned up, he whispered to my sister. When they were gone, Grandma Pat came over and gave me a big hug. I fooled you, didn't I? Yeah, I admitted. That cut looked so convincing. Together, we walked out of the room and started heading back toward their house. All the neighbors walked with us. Grandpa ran out of the back room to catch up with us and explain that Greta would be back soon. He was just washing off the fake blood. When we reached the house, all the neighbors congratulated my grandparents and then wandered back to their own homes. Then the three of us walked inside without Greta. Grandma offered me some tea that she'd already brewed. The three of us sat at the kitchen table. I was about to drink from my cup when I noticed that both my grandparents were staring at me. It was like they were waiting for me to drink it. I knew it was unbelievable, but I sensed that they were trying to poison me. All of this was real. They weren't playing a practical joke on me. That was just what they'd said, so I let them finish off Greta. My sister really had been hurt, and now they wanted to do the same thing to me. I set down my tea and said that I needed to use the bathroom. Grandma Pat looked suspicious. Drink your tea first, she ordered. Just give me a second, I said, trying to act like nothing was wrong. I rushed into the bathroom where I pulled out my phone and called the police. I told them the truth, that my grandparents and their neighbors were involved in some sort of harvesting scheme. I told them I wasn't safe here. The policewoman on the phone didn't say anything at first. Then she scolded me for making a prank call and hung up. Grandma Pat pounded on the door. Let me in, she screamed. She wasn't going to stop. Eventually, I said, okay. Then I casually pushed open the door and walked right past my grandma. I acted like everything was fine, like I completely believed in their wild lies. Then I started running. I shoved past them, opened the door and raced out into the street. Another resident had left his golf cart running, so I jumped in it and drove off. The driver ran after me, screaming, but I was too fast. It didn't take me long to get to the police station. Now that the cops saw me in person, they could tell that I wasn't pulling a prank. They took my statement and asked me a bunch of questions. Then, they took me back to the retirement community so I can show them the operating room where Greta was taken. When we got there, all the evidence had been removed. A few of the neighbors came over and gave their statements, telling the police that I had made everything up. Both my grandparents came over and said the same thing. They said that Greta had never been there. The police left after that. I still didn't know what to do. All of this sounds so crazy, and I can't find anyone that will believe me. I don't think I'll ever find Greta again. And I'm worried that my grandparents and their whole community will keep kidnapping people and stealing organs. Someone needs to stop them.